This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 18th of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Today I'm joined by our Toronto correspondent and literary critic, Christopher Frey, for this week's book review. We'll be exploring the idea of consciousness in Howard Ackler's latest book, Men of Action. We'll find out why we've been gazing into our crystal balls for too long with Hal Nijvitsky's latest release, Trees on Mars, Our Obsessions with the Future. And we'll take a tour of 20th century communist Europe in Owen Hathley's Landscapes of Communism. That's all to come on today's edition of the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. We start the show with Men of Action. It was written by Howard Ackler after his father underwent brain surgery and slipped into a coma. In the book, he reflects on the complicated texture of consciousness and how well you can ever know another human being. Chris, welcome to the show. First of all, how has Ackler approached this book? I mean, is it a memoir?
Maybe loosely you could frame it as a memoir, or I guess what you call like a grief memoir. And it contains, you know, many of the tropes that you'd expect from it, like, the father-son relationship, what we inherit from our parents, and I'm talking about money, the preparations for loss, because, you know, this protracted period where his father's in a coma leads into this story about the nature of consciousness and watching somebody very close to you lose theirs. But he transfigures like this grief memoir into something far more creative and resonant, largely by syncopating his story with these mini essays or digressions on the nature of consciousness, neurological research, theories of narrative. I mean, some of it's very heady and somewhat esoteric, but all these thoughts are made much more immediate, you know, with the old man lying there on his deathbed.
And so when he goes on these tangents, does he become quite philosophical? Is it well-researched, or is it more of a kind of musing, sort of in layman's terms?
I'd say it's a nice balance between the two. I mean, the thing, what's interesting about the book is its structure and Ackler's use of language. Now, first of all, it's structured in a somewhat disjointed manner that I would say is more true to life and how we remember. It unfolds in these brief flashes or episodes, and each section or chapter is no more than a page or two. So you have these sparse page layouts that give Men of Action the impression of a book of poetry, which is also the effect of Ackler's use of language, this understated, compacted, lyrical use of language that, you know, there's this very affecting opening scene where he shaves his father in a coma for the first time, and there's this mole by his father's ear splattered with foam, which reminds him of, like, a fire hydrant in a snowdrift. So it's this nice balance of, like, poetic detail, musings. I mean, I wouldn't say he gives short shrift to the sort of the neurological stuff. It's definitely present, but it's more in how it like bounces off the details of his life and his father's life.
I mean, at 128 pages, it is quite a short book, and as you say, the language is poetic. Do you find it? I mean, do you find it gets into the detail enough, or is it kind of skating across the surface, really?
Well, it's not billed as a book like of neurological study or a deep philosophical treatise. I think ultimately it does come back to Howard in his story and his relationship with his father. And I think this works perfectly well for the book. It's what made the book one of my favorite books, if not my favorite book of 2015, you know, in this very disorienting experience of watching his father die. And in a way that is not only poetic, but like I said, sort of feels more true to life and the disjointed nature of how we live it and how we remember it.
And I mean, you've mentioned the sort of father-son motif quite a lot, and it's obviously called Men of Action. How is that relationship between father and son portrayed and dealt with in this book?
I mean, touchingly, but I should point out, too, that the book in its own fashion is often quite funny. I mean, just contrasting his father's workaholic style, this guy who refuses to ever fully retire, he was an accountant. Meanwhile, the author, Howard Ackler, mocks his own lack of productivity, you know, allowing that it took him it took him 8 years to write his previous novel, The City Man, which only weighed in at a mighty 160 pages. you know, it took him less time to write the more slender book of Men of Action. But what's really interesting is how the act of writing becomes one of the book's key themes and investigations. There's so much unknown about the inner lives and experiences of those closest to us, and much of how the mind works will always elude our understanding. So all we have left to close the gap is this imperfect language, and one that can never fully express what we want to describe. And there's something about this book to me that feels like, you know, there's this noble failure. Like, failure was almost a part of this book's mission, because he understands that he can't quite get at, you know, that unknowable, you know, territory of his father's, you know, consciousness and mind. And you know, there's already the natural distance and ambiguity in the relationships we have with our fathers. But here he performs something quite magical. And with what's interesting, with all these blank spaces on the page that let us breathe a little bit more, it gets us this like hair closer to the unknowable.
Men of Action by Howard Ackler is out now, published by Perseus in the UK and Coach House in Canada. Next on our list today is Trees on Mars, Our Obsessions with the Future by cultural commentator Hal Niedźwiecki. In this work, he meets people at colleges, tech conferences and corporations to find out why we're so focused on what's to come. Chris, what is Niedźwiecki's main criticism here of looking to the future?
Well, it's pretty wide-ranging stuff, but I guess, you know, what he's doing is tracking our growing obsession, as he puts it, with owning the future or getting to the future first. I think he writes somewhere, it's not just the present that we're, you know, repeatedly trying to shape and control. Increasingly, it's the future that we're obsessed with. So that it's something that, as individuals, not necessarily as a society, we're being told to contest, buy, sell, and bring into being. So, you know, he manages to pull all this stuff together in one quite compelling narrative. Although the thesis in the end is or the conclusions are quite troubling. But you know, as you mentioned, he drops in on startups, new media conferences. He visits the campus of those leading edge tech companies. But some of the most poignant stories come not from these high-minded futurists or entrepreneurs, but everyday people with some outsized dream to create that, you know, world-altering app or be part of the first colony on Mars. But you know, to get at his thesis, I mean, we might roughly say we're probably doomed, you know, unless we begin to accept that technology alone will not help us solve or escape, you know, our current ecological and social dilemmas, that what we really need to do is radically alter our collective behavior. Unfortunately, for Niedźwiecki, there's scant evidence of that. Like, we've rarely shown either the capacity or the willingness to change to the degree that's, you know, rapidly becoming necessary if we're to avert some impending crises.
So it seems to be his point is more that we need to think differently about the future rather than, I guess he's not saying we should live more in the present and stop thinking about the future so much. He's kind of trying to change the narrative there, is he?
No, in some way, that's his final conclusion is because he is a skeptic. I think he doesn't have a lot of hope. I mean, I have to, you know, I confess here, Hal is a friend and a colleague, and he has two children. And on the one hand, I read this book through him as a writer, and his conclusions are more or less that we need to focus more on being in the present, and prepare ourselves for whatever comes next by focusing on making that present matter more. You know, one of the reasons this book works so well still are these terrific little character sketches or vignettes. I don't want to give the impression that the book is heavy on theory or heavy on reporting. And these little character sketches or vignettes, he illustrates how these ideas about the future or our embrace in the future animate and connect with people's lives, and not just tech moguls. Like, there's this one married woman in Alberta, in Canada, who hopes to win a spot in the first Mars colony. And I think she succeeds in getting past the first test. So she's on, whatever, the very long, long list of contenders who might finally make it into the mission. But, you know, as a child, she dreamt of being an astronaut, so she has some, you know, sense of adventure that this entails. She'll also have to divorce her husband, who, you know, there's a joke in there that it'll be the easiest divorce ever because he just gets everything. But, you know, for her, space travel is also this, and I think this is the way we often think about technology, that space travel will serve as this catalyst for other technologies. And, you know, consider what we might learn from trying to grow food on Mars. And here's where the symbolism from the book's title comes from, that if, you know, we think we're going to accomplish some of these big, fantastical, techno-utopian projects, that somehow the rest of our problems will work themselves out.
When you read this, I mean, do you see a sense of irony, I guess, that, you know, he's talking about our obsessions with the future, and yet this is a book that kind of looks at the future as well, and sort of adds to that entire dialogue?
In some ways, but I think what's really important about the book is embedded throughout. I mean, whether or not you fully, you know, agree with his arguments, embedded throughout are some very pointed critiques about major shifts in society, such as the decline in institutions, the embrace of big data, and the confidence in the predictive power of big data to improve our lives and solve major problems. Even smaller details like the decimation of university humanities departments, where, you know, entire programs are being shuttered. You know, unless, of course, you can opportunistically insert the word digital, you know, in a course title. And there's another nugget that stands out, too, in that for all the talk of putting more computers or devices in classrooms, whether in the rich world or the poor world, it may not actually be making our children any smarter or better equipped. In fact, much of the available evidence suggests that educational outcomes among children with access to tablets and computer actually declines. You know, their math and reading scores deteriorate. So I think, you know, if you might don't quite glom on to his central thesis, there's certainly a lot of really valuable critique in there about contemporary society that's worth noting.
That was Trees on Mars, Our Obsessions with the Future by Hal Niedzwiecki, which is out now published by Seven Stories Press. The final book on today's show is Landscapes of Communism, the latest tome by British politics and architecture writer Owen Hatherley. This tells a history of 20th century communist Europe through the buildings this period threw up. Tell us a little bit more about this one, first of all, Chris.
Well, I've long been a fan of Hatherley's writings on architecture, largely because I share his interest in brutalism and concrete architecture, the legacy of the Russian avant-garde, for example, topics that he's written about before. And I have to admit, I first read this in a somewhat disordered manner as it arrived in stores last summer, just before I was going on another trip to Moscow, and I hadn't been there in 8 years. And so the book served me as something like this wonderful companion commentary track, though it's by no means a straightforward architectural guide covering, you know, the Eastern Bloc and the Soviet Union, the architectural legacy of these countries. You know, the book itself is organized more by theme and concept than place or period. So I went through the book according to its index and entries having to do with Moscow, which, you know, are scattered throughout the book. So I tracked down many of the buildings and sites that Hatherley describes there that I wasn't already familiar with, and revisited others with a fresh lens, usually with some added layer of history or anecdote or aesthetic consideration. I think Hatherley might even approve of the book being consumed in this way because he's provided a secondary index according to places.
Okay.
The book, I mean, he spent, I think, something like 5 years traveling through much of the post-Soviet Eastern Bloc countries, you know, from Berlin to Moscow, Vilnius to Kiev. He offers a history of communist Europe through its buildings and public spaces. You know, he covers at 600 pages, it's voluminous, we'll say. I mean, almost every building typology and architectural wave comes up for closer examination and a reappraisal of their legacy. You know, there's the grand boulevards or magistrales, you know, that any good socialist city needs for a big parade with military hardware. There's those densely packed, what they were called, micro-rayons, those slab apartment blocks that were built across Russia. You know, the more odd and fanciful towers that may have served better as sculptures than working buildings. And of course, you know, the metro stations, principally the Moscow metro. But, you know, that format, those resplendent underground palaces of the metro, were not just a feature of Moscow. It was something that was repeated across much of the Soviet bloc.
I mean, we should also mention that the story is also, you know, it's factual, as you've mentioned, but it's also, there's a personal history here as well. I mean, he goes on a journey to find out more information about his own family, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. I don't know that that's exactly true. If anything, it's like sort of the resonance of his family through this architecture. And what's interesting, and one of the criticisms that the book has come in for, is that there's not a lot of people in it. I mean, as I said, it's a densely packed 600 pages, you know, almost as densely packed as one of those, you know, Soviet apartment blocks. But he spends much more time talking about the historical context, the ideas behind the work, and his own, you know, personal impressions. And on that, I think it works. I mean, it pulls you headlong into this, like, dizzying survey of not just styles, but, you know, as I said, the ideas that animated them. And he's by no means predictable or programmatic in his assessments. Much of the book's pleasure is derived from, you know, his very singular appreciations or perceptions of the architecture and the spaces and his knack for description. The one that stands out for me is, you know, looking at one of these monumental reliefs with the, you know, the good socialist workers on it. He describes them having granite cheekbones you could cut yourself on. So There isn't so much of that personal history. It's there a little bit in the book, but I think it really is populated by buildings and spaces.
Landscapes of Communism by Owen Hatherley was released last June by Penguin and will be re-released by the New Press on 1st of March in North America. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Christopher Frey, thanks very much for joining us from Toronto. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow when we'll be speaking to film critic Tim Robey at the Berlin Film Festival. But for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.